All right. We're not done yet. So suddenly, he pierces the silence with an equally unearthly cry of abandonment, of God's forsakenness, the cry of dereliction. Jesus echoes the forlorn words of David, my God, why have you forsaken me? In Psalm 22:1. And again, it's interesting that it's the first portion of that, because in Matthew 27:46, that's his decree, or his cry out. But that would be realizing exactly who's around the cross. And so, you know, if we were to put my millennial spin on it, if I was talking about songs and I said, somebody, well, everybody knows that Smash Mouth is after that. And so this is Jesus on the cross referencing something that the Jewish people would know at the foot of the cross. So much so that even some of the Roman soldiers take realization to what is going on, how unique this is, that this guy who shouldn't really be up here is an important person that is the Son of God. And so he's referencing exactly what's happening in the rest of Psalm 22 by this small portion, which is hard for him to eke out, because we see him just saying one or two words or short phrases at the cross, because of course he would. So as darkness descends on Calvary at noon, it becomes a nightmarish image of the absence of God in hell. Jesus is cast into this outer darkness, the scapegoat taken beyond the cosmos, the realm of order and beauty, sinking instead into a black hole which no light could penetrate, and from which in and of itself nothing benign or meaningful could ever emanate. Again, the importance of that, and how that's just a brush up of what we can kind of understand from our perspective.
Right.
And there Jesus bears the unbearable in its completeness, satisfying every last demand of God's just wrath against those for whom the Son died.
Mm. Yeah.
And the importance of that.
And yet Christensen tells us that what nobody knows except God is that the darker the sky grows, the more certain it is that the darkness would be defeated.
Yeah. Right? Again, this is the Christian message. Yet.
Yeah.
That's the word. That's the word, right, that you start with. That's yet. Right. And yet.
Yeah. And yet. Right. Yeah. So supreme glory then is preceded and thus enhanced by the foulest sin that this ugly realm could conjure.
Right.
At the moment when Christ took on himself the sin of the world, his figure on the cross was the most grotesque, right, most obscene mass of consecrated sin in the history of the world. The Son as man was abandoned by the Father so that those of us who trust in him for pardon will never be abandoned.
That's why we give our sin to Christ, and in equal fashion, we get the best quality, which is God's righteousness on us. That's part of the adoption process right there.
All right.
How about the mystery of Christ's suffering?
Yeah.
Is it a mystery? Well, it seems like it. It seems like this leads us to the looming question about the nature of the Father-Son breach expressed in the cry of dereliction. Orthodoxy rejects Patripassianism.
So father, right? Passive, right?
Right.
Right. So God is not passive, right? So patripassivism.
There you go.
Something like that. Right?
Put it in Greek. Well, it'll be way better. Or Latin. Yeah. We'll just play clips of R.C. Sproul saying it. That'll be easier. The idea that God the Father suffers as did the Son in the work of redemption. Okay, so patripassianism is historically connected to the heresy of Sabellianism. That one I know. Modalism. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea that the Father and the Son and the Spirit are the same person, and they just take on these different modes when to express themselves. So the Father comes down as the Son, suffers there in the garden. He's talking to himself. And then when he ascends up into heaven, then he changes himself into the Holy Spirit.
This is the one I always think of the hat theory. Right? God changes hats depending on what he's doing, right?
Yeah. And I think there's a Bugs Bunny cartoon about that. So this modalism says that, which it says the Father morphs into the Son incarnate and thereby suffers as the Son. The Father did not suffer in any direct manner. Only the Son underwent the palpable pain of redemption. Furthermore, only the human nature of Christ suffered loss.
That's an important, very important.
Only the human nature of him suffers. The divine nature cannot suffer loss and cannot die. Again, we kind of established that before.
And that's why he had to be both man and God.
Right, exactly, right? Exactly. Yeah. And again, not a mixture, not half and half. Right. He's not this demigod Hercules person. He has
two
fully
natures.
Fully God and fully man.
Yeah, the nature of God and the nature of man.
Right. This would be an absurdity of the highest order. Likewise, there was no rupture or even the threat of rupture in the Trinity on the cross or during the cry of dereliction. There was no breach in the same divine essence shared by the Father, Son, and the Spirit.
Right. So they were still, he was still part of the Trinity. Right. He was still God.
He was still upholding the normal processes of the universe on the cross at the worst moment in history. Yeah. That's how great of a God he is.
Yeah. And so, you know, the question then is, what exactly happened then on the cross, right? So he says, in order to understand the tension, right, it is important to note another doctrine worked out in the Christology of the early church called the communication of properties.
You get the easier words.
Yeah. There is a word there, but I kind of took it out.
Okay, okay. Yeah. I see how it is.
The idea here is that the divine nature has unique properties or attributes that are distinct from the properties or attributes of human nature, right? And so the divine is impassible, as we saw earlier, right. And the human is passible. The divine is immortal. The human is mortal. The divine is all-powerful. The human is weak. The divine is immutable, unchangeable. The human is mutable, changeable. The divine is untemptable. The human is temptable, and so forth. So the unique attributes that belong only to the divine nature cannot be shared by the human nature and vice versa, right? So that gives us a glimpse then how to deal with this particular issue, right?
It helps. It's hard. This is the part of the chapter that I had to rewrite and reread, and then again, my underline should have been the opposite because I should have underlined what I didn't want to remember. But I have a lot of stars and a lot of underlines and question marks and everything like that. So it's a thing to struggle with, and I think it's good for us to struggle with. And I'm not just saying that so that I look very humble and good, but it's a difficult concept because. Of just how important the incarnation is, and that's the entirety of the incarnation.
All right. Mm-hmm.
So this leads to the doctrine stating that the properties or the attributes of the theanthropic persons, two natures, cannot be communicated to one another at the level of nature, but that some properties can be communicated at the level of person.
So notice he's making then again this distinction between Jesus Christ's natures,
right,
and he as a person. Mm-hmm. So two natures in one person. And so these things can be communicated, he says, to one another in his person, but not in his natures.
Right. Especially when we talk about if you're doing kind of a systematic theology. I think Grudem starts out with the communicable and incommunicable characteristics of God that he shares with humans. And so things like love, but then things like all presence is not there. And so so in a similar fashion, we're talking about that with the incarnate Christ and the Father. So the divine nature of Jesus participates in the suffering of the human nature. Not directly, but rather because the two natures are joined together in the person of the Son. This prevents both the person-nature distinction and the very important creator-creature distinction from being violated.
Right. So they're distinct even in the one person.
Right.
Right. Yeah, right. That's what he's getting at.
This is where, Jesus on the cross and the prophecy says that no bone should be broken. And we know that the Roman soldiers would go around, and if the people needed to die sooner, they'd break their legs. They come up to Jesus about ready.
Because they were using their legs to hold themselves up so they could breathe. But, right?
Because you want them to excruciatingly consist for days at a time.
Yeah.
But the Passover was coming, and you didn't want a big riot because Jews were hanging on a tree, which was already bad enough. Could that have been the case that it would go against. Well, theoretically, yes. Like the Roman soldiers could have done it, but in the confines of God's movements in history, was that possible? Well, no. And in similar fashion, could Jesus Christ himself have had sinned if he wanted to? Well, his human nature had kind of the ability to sin if so desired, but the divine nature in the being of Jesus kind of wouldn't allow it. And so
the person of Jesus. Yeah, good. So what about the Father then? Well, Christensen tells us that furthermore, since there is an interpersonal unity or mutual indwelling between the persons of the, you know, the Father and the Son and the Spirit, then the Father also participates in the suffering of the Son, though again, not directly, right? So there is a strange and incomprehensible sense in which it both pleased and grieved the Father to crush his beloved Son. And so we can affirm that God, via the incarnation, came to mysteriously know human pain and suffering and anguish firsthand, and in the same human manner that we experience it, right? He experienced it as in his human nature, in his person, as in the incarnation.
Right. It was his plan to start with, too. Yeah.